Hello, I'm William Shakespeare, and this is Part-Time Fanboy, the Kill Shakespeare interview.
I'm Christian Horn. I'm here on Part-Time Fanboy, and I'm here with the creators, well, the co-writers of the IDW comic book hit Kill Shakespeare, Anthony Del Cole, right? Is that how I pronounce it?
Del Cole, yeah, yeah.
Del Cole and Connor McCreary. And you guys are both the co-writers on this book, correct?
That is correct, yeah. Connor and I are the co-creators and co-writers of Kill Shakespeare.
So I guess the first question I kind of have for both of you is, what came first, comics or Shakespeare? Which one, what was your first love as far as, you know, coming towards this book?
I would probably say, I mean, I started out with more Shakespeare. It was a Shakespeare the comics. When Connor and I first started, we kind of joked around that I was the Shakespeare geek and Connor was the comic geek. And somehow we've kind of now morphed roles depending on the day and the time. I started to get really interested in Shakespeare. Back in high school, I had some really good teachers. My sister was big into Shakespeare. She went on to do her master's in English Lit. One of the benefits we have being located here in Toronto or in Ontario, Canada, is that we have access to the Stratford Shakespeare Festival, which is the top Shakespeare festival in North America. So going to see it performed by some of the top actors in the world just really brings it to life. I've been inspired by Shakespeare since then.
Oh, well, what about you, Connor? Were you pretty much mostly comics to start off with, or were you always into Shakespeare or like literature, I guess?
I kind of had the same path as Anthony in terms of how I discovered Shakespeare, which was, you know, through high school and having some good teachers and getting to go to the Stratford Festival. But when I was a little kid, I was definitely a comics nerd. I actually remember when I first saw The Tempest, and I saw the character Caliban sort of live and in front of me. You know, my first thought as a little, 14-year-old fanboy was, "Oh, wow, that's like the Shakespearean Wolverine." while I was lucky that I got in, you know, I got infused with a love of Shakespeare from a young age, I was definitely a comics nerd ahead of time. I remember going to the drugstore. You know, back in the day when drugstores used to actually carry comics. And then you'd only get so many issues in a series as the drugstore actually brought in. So I remember growing up and having a lot of, you know, 3 out of 6 issues in a mini series, and sort of always having to wonder how they ended. So yeah, I always loved comics growing up.
Oh wow! So you didn't have comic shops up there or anything like that?
Well, I mean, when I was a kid, because I'm like 36 now, and so I mean, there weren't so many comic shops. There was a couple of really good ones downtown, and I live sort of in the burbs. And so, yeah, you mostly had to go to the local drugstore or supermarket back when they used to have them on the newsstand, and you never knew what was going to be there. So I ended up reading a bunch of kind of everything because, yeah, there wasn't a local comic shop. I was kind of in the middle of nowhere a little bit. You know, now it's like 3 comic shops where I grew up, but when I was a kid, yeah, I was out of luck.
Wow. So before this series, you were both well-versed in, I guess, Shakespeare and literature. I mean, you both have entertainment backgrounds, correct? And writing backgrounds beyond this, right, Anthony?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we both have those sorts of backgrounds. And Connor has written a couple of screenplays that have gotten development funding from some of the top funding agencies here in Canada. We're fortunate being in Canada, again, not to toot our patriotic, we're fortunate in that we have agencies like the federal government through Telefilm Canada and the Harold Greenberg Fund, which is run by one of the major broadcasters. They actually have provide financial support for screenwriters. So Connor has gone through a couple phases with a couple of projects, and we've had some television deals in the past, and I've produced a couple feature films. So yeah, we have a film TV background, but this Kill Shakespeare was our first comic project.
Wow. And so who came to who? How did you guys meet?
Well, Anthony and I, actually, we both went to the same university just west of Toronto called Wilfrid Laurier, and we actually didn't know each other there. Good old Wilfred Laurier. Go you Golden Hawks.
Oh, boy.
And though we actually didn't know each other, but one of Anthony's friends, Kevin Nasser, was the little brother of my buddy Mike Nasser from high school. And so Mike had said, hey, my little brother Kevin knows this guy who went to Laurier, and he's really into film, but he was a business student, just like you. You guys should meet. And so Anthony and I met up, and it turned out we both had a strange fascination for a children's novel by a Canadian writer named Gordon Corman. And the book was called No Coins, Please. It was all about this little kid in a tuxedo, you know, doing these crazy money-making schemes across North America. And both of us had thought, you know, this would be such an awesome movie. And so we kind of bonded on that, you know, same, you know, we couldn't believe that both of us liked this same book. It was just mentioned randomly in conversation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after we decided not to try to take the other guy out, because we figured there should only be one Laurier business graduate, you know, trying to make it in the film world. Mm-hmm. Anthony was pretty wily. I had to avoid a lot of death traps. But he eventually respected my resilience, and I forgave him for losing one of my arms. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Nice.
Oh, you see, cool. I mean, the question you had before was influence over Shakespeare, and I'm heavily influenced by Iago. So what I like is how he finds a target and he does whatever to take them out. Unfortunately, I'm not that well versed in Shakespeare, so maybe I missed a couple times. So Connor's still around.
Oh wow, that's great. So have you worked on other projects before this, before like Kill Shakespeare, or is this like your first sort of joint venture?
Yeah, Connor and I have worked on, we worked on a couple projects together. They're mainly in children's animation, actually.
Oh, wow.
We had a children's television animated series in development with Shaftesbury Films here in Canada, which is one of the top production companies. And Teletoon, which is like the Cartoon Network up here, was kind of circling it. It was called Global RPS. RPS stands for Rock, Paper, Scissors, where it's Scooby-Doo meets Pokemon. In the near future, Rock, Paper, Scissors is the biggest sporting entertainment event in the world. Our story is circled on three main characters, three young phenoms who just joined the tour, and every stop they go to take part in tournaments, they get involved in local adventures, they solve crimes and mysteries, that sort of thing.
So when you say
it's kind of like Scooby-Doo meets Pokemon.
Oh, gotcha. And when you say tournaments, are you talking about like rock, paper, scissor tournaments?
Oh yeah. In the future, everybody wears these holotech gloves. So if you throw rock and I throw paper, it's not just our fists, our hands doing the talking. Your glove projects this, you know, 50-foot rock creature. Mine projects this, you know, 75-foot paper monster. They do battle in front of everybody, you know, and the crowds just eat it up. And so, yeah, our context was our heroes were so good, such naturally gifted athletes, that even when they weren't in the ring, that sort of augments this power, they could use the powers of the rock, the paper, and the scissor spirits to sort of solve crimes, smooth over wars between neighboring factions and the like. And yeah, so we built a really fun mythology behind it, and this one production company really liked it. It was an early lesson for us in that we actually had some preliminary animation done on the series. Uh-huh. But ultimately the series didn't go. So it was sort of it was the first time we got paid for an idea of ours and the first time we watched it sort of die. Anthony also helped us with co-wrote this script called Bike Man with another friend of ours named Thomas Street, and Anthony helped shepherd that through up here in Canada through one of the funding bodies, so we got money for that script, and that was another thing that we had some interest in, and then watched the company that had said, hey, yeah, you know, we might want to read this could be an interesting project. We watched them go bankrupt after their first feature film. Mm-hmm. The much, much mourned Pinocchio 3K, which was Pinocchio set in space in the future.
Wow.
I don't know why that didn't make any money.
Wasn't there another old Pinocchio animated like in space thing? I seem to remember something from the 70s. Could be wrong. I don't know. So who's sitting around and thinking one day like the light bulb goes off like Shakespeare, comics, like we should do this?
Well, Connor and I actually, it was almost 10 years ago now. God, 10 years ago. Wow. Wow. Back 10 years ago, I did not have any gray hairs. I just want to have a moment of silence for that. To all the, all my brown hairs that have gone since. No, I mean, 10 years ago, Connor and I were sitting around brainstorming ideas for video games. And the title Kill Bill came up because the films had just come out, I believe. We thought, wow, that'd make a great video game, but I'm sure it's already been done or it's in development or something like that. So somehow it went from Kill Bill to Kill Bill Shakespeare and all those characters, and that was the grand eureka moment. We leaned back and said, wow, that's like a really cool idea. I'd love to see that. And then instead of a video game, we thought of it as a feature film. We sat down over the span of 6 months or so and wrote a 20-page treatment to what the story would look like, which is very similar to what it is today, with one or two major exceptions. But then we shelved it for a while because Connor was busy in broadcast journalism. He was working at Business News Network, which is kind of the MSNBC, Connor, I guess? So he was busy with that. I was busy in the music industry on the management side, helping to manage some top artists here in Canada. And it was about May of 2007 where we kind of pulled it out of the drawer and said, "Well, let's do something with this." And we kind of looked around to figure out what the best way to bring this to life was, whether it was a feature or video game or anything else. And then we kind of hit on comics because Connor had actually been working at the Silver Snail here in Toronto, which is one of the top stores in the country. Mm-hmm. Go Canada! Woo!
In the world!
Wow, you guys are so incredibly patriotic. You make Americans seem like nothing, like our patriotism. You've mentioned Go Canada at least three times.
Face tattoo.
Oh, jeez. So Connor was working at a comic shop, at the best comic shop in the world.
Yeah, it was actually kind of funny because Anthony was the one, though, who first said, "Well, what about a comic?" And I remember saying, "Well, I don't know, man, because, you know, the only sword and sorcery thing that was selling at all back then was Conan. And even that was kind of a niche book, right? I mean, it was a bunch of older guys mostly, and then a few kind of metalheads who would, you know, read Conan." Uh-huh. And so I was sort of like, I don't know if sword and sorcery, I don't know if it's got a place in comics. But we chatted about it more. We sort of were like, you know, maybe that's the opportunity, is that there aren't a lot of books like this in the comic world. And of course, you know, Shakespearean, you know, fans of Shakespeare are also people who like to read interesting things. And this was, of course, comics were blowing up in terms of more sophisticated storytelling. And we sort of thought, you know, Anthony and I both sort of said, you know, comics and theater are sort of similar. They're both this weird hybrid of the visual and the verbal, as well as the fact that stage plays and comics are almost always a little bit magical, a little bit surrealistic. Even a kitchen sink play or a kitchen sink comic book, there's something about perspective and lighting and those sort of arts that make those stories always a little bit more than just, you know, just real. And yeah, the more we kind of looked at it, the more we thought this actually would probably be a medium that Shakespeare would have played with. You know, because he's famous for writing about, gosh, if I could show you this, I would have. I wish I could have showed you the pirate attack, or I wish I could have shown you the Battle of Agincourt. And instead, you know, he just talks about it. Where in comics, you know, if you want to draw, you know, you need a pitched battle between two massive armies, you don't need millions of dollars to stage that. You just need, you know, a talented artist like Andy Belanger, who we've got, to draw it, and boom, you have this epic battle.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, his art is absolutely, I love his art from the beginning. I've loved it from the first issue that, you know, I read. I thought it was just fantastic. And in this new miniseries, The Tide of Blood, it seems like he's changed his, like I said in my review on the website, he's changed his style just a little bit, but I still love it. I think it's really impressive work. Let me go back a little. How do you guys like work together? Like you said, you started with a 20-page treatment. How does that sort of, do you guys just throw out ideas and somebody sits down at a, I was going to say typewriter, but that's just me showing my age at like a computer and starts typing away, or how did that work?
We actually script Kill Shakespeare on tablets. Not of the iPod variety, but of the old stone tablets. We like the old school Mozart thing. So
I'm thinking of graduating to papyrus.
You'll get to the ink press soon enough. The moving type, I guess.
That's for shame, Kristen. That's the devil's machinery.
Nice.
Yes.
Nice.
How dare you?
Well, but I mean, beyond that, seriously, like, how do you guys work? Is it just like throwing out ideas? Like, this would be great. Like, how did you choose like Hamlet as sort of the center of, you know, the original miniseries?
Well, it's funny that you asked that specific question, because Hamlet originally was not going to be the main character. Uh-huh. Our original take on Bill Shakespeare when he first conceived the idea was that it would be someone from today's world, like it could be you or it could be me or Connor, and who, you know, this individual finds like a portal or wormhole into the Shakespearean land. Mm-hmm. You know, very much like the Matrix and that sort of thing. And they get into this world, and then they meet Juliet and Falstaff and Othello and all the other main characters that we have in the series. And then we kind of, like, that was, like I said, that was the first pass that we did. And then we just thought about it and thought, well, you know, that character was like a police officer who had just had, I think his father passed away or a family member passed away, and he was kind of in a funk and a depression. Mm-hmm. And so we were just afraid when it came, you know, when we pulled the story out of the drawer again back in 07, so almost 6 years ago now, we were just afraid that the tone would be off. Mm-hmm. We were afraid that people would perceive it more to be like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Gotcha. Than The Matrix. You know, despite the fact that Connor does have the biggest man crush of all time on Keanu Reeves, we decided that we wouldn't want to do Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And it's true. And oh. Speaking of which, Keanu Reeves, also Canadian.
Oh, brother. any chance you get. Wow. At least it's warm where I am right now. I'm in California, so.
California does have the highest concentration of Canadians living in it of any state in the Union. So,
and now you know why, because it's like 80 degrees here right now.
you're killing me.
Sorry, it's why I'll never move to Canada. I can't stand the cold. But what about Hamlet? That just like was like, oh, he's got to be the guy. Why not Romeo or, you know, Othello or any of the others?
Well, I think it's, you know, a little bit like what Anthony was saying. You know, we wanted this everyman, this Josh Chance type character. I think that was his original name. You know, and it was this notion of the story was somewhat similar in that he was going to be faced with the option of killing or saving Shakespeare, but depending on what he chose, it was going to either save or doom this important person in his life. And, you know, we were like, it could be his father, maybe it was his fiance. And, you know, once, as Anthony said, we realized that people might not get the tone and might make it too confusing if it was, is this a Shakespeare world or is this our world? Mm-hmm. We thought, well, you know, if you want to have a character that is tortured by a family issue, I mean, Hamlet, that's the guy, right? I mean, he's the blueprint for people struggling with making tough decisions based on love of family or being compelled by their family to do something. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it became this natural notion of, well, what if Hamlet could get his father back? How far would he go? You know, we know in the play, it's a tragedy. There's blood on the floor everywhere. But for our Hamlet, you know, one of the key questions was, if he's in this new world and he still has this quest kind of given to him by his father, is he a bloody-minded character or is he going to look for another option, either another way to save his father without there being bloodshed? Or is he eventually maybe even looking and saying, saving my father is a good thing, but not if it comes at the cost of all these other characters, of all these other people. And so we wanted to give Hamlet a chance to move past the tragedy of his play and maybe make another choice.
Nice. Yeah, I'm also curious about how you went beyond, like, say, the original plays, like in Kill Shakespeare, Juliet's like a general, or she's sort of like a rebel leader in the first miniseries, and, you know, she obviously hasn't died, or, you know, it didn't end tragically for them, like Romeo and Juliet. How did you decide, okay, we're just going to go beyond that, we're going to kind of, I don't know if the proper term is ignore it, just take a step beyond, like, what the original Shakespeare works did, not to be confined by them? Do you understand? Does that make sense?
No, exactly. I mean, what we kind of did was reverse engineer everything. So, I mean, we knew that we really wanted Juliet, not only because she's probably the most famous female character that Shakespeare's written, arguably. You could say Lady Macbeth as well, or you could make the case for a couple others. But, I mean, we wanted to put her in it for her name value, but also we wanted to kind of grow her beyond what she's kind of perceived as. And if you talk to a lot of high school girls or even young women, in their 20s, the common perception of Juliet is that she's a whiny little teenage schoolgirl. Uh-huh. Like, oh, The love was so fickle, and she's really rash, and she's not rational at all, and that sort of thing. And so we wanted to kind of put that new spin on it. So knowing that we wanted to put her in there and kind of analyzing the character that she was in the play, we kind of figured out, okay, well, what would she be in 7 or 8 years? And that's where we kind of figured out that she drives, she actually, if you analyze the text and analyze the original play, she actually drives a lot of that story. Like, she's the one that tells Romeo, no, you know, if you want to move on, or, you know, if you want to be with me, then you have to marry me. You know, like, come and meet me at this time here, at this place there. Like, those sorts of things. And so we kind of saw, well, if she was so determined and strong at that age, then, you know, if you flash forward 7, 8, 9, 10 years later, and having to deal with the tragedy in her past, a.k.a. Romeo's death, that, you know, it would just be inevitable that she would kind of, to atone for the mistakes that she feels she's made, or the guilt that she has over them, that she, you know, she'd turn into becoming this sort of general character, as you said.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting that you guys had sort of the courage to kind of go the way that you did, because, I mean, I even said it sort of in my review for, you know, the new miniseries, the first issue, The Tide of Blood, that, you know, a lot of people could come to this and be like, excuse me? I don't understand. Like, you guys seem to have a lot of faith in your audience to be able to leap past tradition or what's, you know, quote-unquote expected. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, I think that's one of the benefits of doing something in the comic space first, is I think comic readers are very often comfortable with these kind of leaps, whether it's because you've read, you know, a bunch of superhero books, and, you know, superheroes are often reinvented, and so you kind of get used to the notion that the mantle of, you know, Green Lantern, for the sake of argument, can be worn by very, very different types of lanterns. And so I think comics fans, they're okay with things that challenge them. I think the key for hopefully why it works is because we tried to ground everything in what Shakespeare did with his character. So while, yeah, Juliet was never a leader of a rebellion, you know, far from it in her play, you know, you could make a really good case that Juliet is the strongest character in that story. Mm-hmm. You know, she's the one who lasts the longest. She's the one who, when Romeo goes to climb the balcony, is the one asking him, you know, in a loving way, some pretty tough questions, right? I mean, that balcony scene is sort of all about Juliet testing Romeo out to really make sure that he's really in love with her, and that this just isn't, you know, earlier in the play, the guy was totally infatuated with this woman named Rosalind. Uh-huh. So she's a pretty smart, strong-willed girl, and we wanted to give her a chance to become a strong, smart, you know, smart, strong-willed woman. Uh-huh. And so I think people who, when they read our story, people who really know their Shakespeare, they see like a natural progression there for Juliet. And for people who maybe have, as Anthony said, this mindset that, oh, she's just this whiny little schoolgirl, it gives them a reason to kind of look at Juliet again. You know, one of the best letters we got, this actually came to Anthony, was from a girl out in the Maritimes of Canada who'd read Romeo and Juliet, really didn't like Juliet, and was then given by her mom the first, I think it was the first trade of Kill Shakespeare. And she wrote a letter, you know, to Anthony saying, hey, you know, I really wish I'd gotten this comic book before I studied Romeo and Juliet. Wow. I really like Juliet so much more now. It gave me a whole different way of looking at her. And I think that's, you know, I think that's why it works. And I don't, you know, to me, it's not giving too much faith in your audience. I tend to think people are generally pretty smart, and if you challenge them, they'll respond. And the other thing, too, is nowadays, you're just a Google search away from anything that you really need to know. I mean, we would never put in a key plot point that is based on some obscure play, but yeah. I mean, most of our stuff is based on the major stuff. You can Google it really quickly and get a sense of, Romeo, Juliet, balcony, and find out why that reverse balcony scene that we have, why that's, you know, why is that fun in a certain way?
Yeah.
And yeah, so I think people are generally smarter than you give them credit for.
So when you talk about doing research, I mean, how much did you have to go back to the original works before you started, like, your treatment or saying, like, we're going to go through with this? Like, I sort of envision you, like, in a film and, like, all the books are splayed out in front of you, like, madly taking notes, you know, that sort of thing. And, like, oh, Hamlet does this and this and Macbeth and, you know, and just was it like that at all? Did you have to, like, delve yourselves back into the plays, or were you so... did you just go from the knowledge that you had?
just before I answer that, I just wanted to point out something that Connor had mentioned, which was the best piece of fan mail we ever received was from someone from Canada.
Oh, jeez.
Just wanted to point something out there.
You guys are better at everything.
Exactly, except for the weather.
Just universal health care and not starting wars.
Listen, I wish I'm with you. I'm with you. I'm not against you. I'm a California liberal.
You're What's not that? With us. You're not with us. You're in 80-degree weather right now.
Well, yeah, but I mean, whatever. We could talk about that later if you guys are going to WonderCon again. But no, seriously, like, how did you research it? How did you get into it?
When we were first scripting it, like years and years ago, when we were putting together the treatment, I kind of delved into a couple of the plays, and I know Connor delved into a couple of the plays. But when 5 years ago, or 5+ years ago, when we sat down and actually re-scripted for the purpose of the comic book series, we intentionally decided not to do that sort of thing where you'd have all the different Shakespeare works, the complete works of Shakespeare, you know, out and covering your tabletop and everything. Because one of the things that we want to do, which is what Connor and you were just talking about, was we wanted to try to make it as accessible for everyone. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to get caught up in the dogma of small little details or minutiae facts about a particular character or something, but just understand the main gist of what those characters are all about. Because again, we wanted to make this as accessible as possible. What's interesting now, though, is that as we continue on with the series and we are dealing with a lot of Shakespeare academics and scholars, I mean, our dramaturg Dr. Toby Malone here, who's helped us with the theatrical production of Kill Shakespeare, he's done about 3 or 4 academic papers on Kill Shakespeare, and we're being studied by a lot of university academics again these days. So we are actually starting to do a little more research and find small little moments that might be interesting, not only from a visual perspective, but also from a story perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually speaks to the Canadian educational system too, because I would not be able to write anything on Shakespeare without having to go back to the original book. So I'll give you guys credit for that. How did you go about finding your artist?
Well, we're lucky actually. Toronto is quietly something of a hotbed for comics talent. And so when we were originally searching for people, we reached out to some friends of ours in the comics world and some friends of ours in the film and TV world, and we got sort of, you know, we got a trail of breadcrumbs. Actually, I guess given that it was Andy, it would probably be beer-battered pretzel crumbs that led us to the doorstep of Andy Boulanger. And Andy had done some work for Boom and for Wildstorm. He had his own comic, Racing Hell, that he'd done. And so we knew that he knew the game, and he was in the position where he was looking for something that he could make his mark on. And Andy's a huge metal fan. He loves sword and sorcery. And so our take, this kind of slightly creepy, horrific take on Shakespeare in comic form, was right up his alley. But what was the selling point kind of for both of us was Andy loves to play Macbeth. And he was so psyched about the fact that Macbeth was going to be, you know, Macbeth and Lady Macbeth were going to both play pretty big roles, at least early in the book. And he kind of pounded his fist on the table and was like, as long as I get to draw Macbeth, you know, I'm in. And so we're like, hey, great. It's funny, you know, because Anthony was saying, yeah, we didn't want to get too bogged down, trying to be too smart. Oh, look at this really good Shakespeare reference I put in there that you won't get because you don't know enough. Yeah. Andy actually listened to almost every play on tape when he was drawing the first series. He actually probably knows more about Shakespeare right now than we do. We were just lucky. And Andy, he's a great visual storyteller. He's a great guy to work with. He's passionate. You know, he's really smart. We're sad because he now lives in Montreal, an even colder part of Canada. It's great to get to work with a guy like Andy who just brings, like, his heart in his... You know, he puts his heart in his sleeve when he works, and that's... You're lucky when somebody puts that kind of care and love into something that was originally just your little baby.
Nice. How did you come about, like... Did you develop this project like all on your own, or did you pitch it around first and then find the artist, or did you pull a packet together and say, like, go to Image, IDW? How did that all come about?
Well, what we did was, as Connor mentioned before, we both went to business school, so we have a business background pedigree. And so what we did before we even approached any of the publishers was that we went out and raised some private funding. Yeah, we put together a 100-page business plan and raised private equity in the company. And I mean, that's actually still allowing us to, you know, the investors are quite happy. And I mean, we haven't even spent all the funds as of this moment yet, which is nice. So we put the package together. We raised some funding. Then we put together the actual pitch package that we would then go to all the publishers with. And it was in February of 2009 that we trekked down to the New York Comic Con. And that's where we met all the publishers. We met with Greg and Chris at IDW. We met with a number of other publishers. And within a month or two, we had five publishers interested in releasing Kill Shakespeare.
Oh, wow.
Which was interesting. So at that point, yeah, we did have Andy on board. Andy had done up all the character designs, which are still on the website, and still when we're referencing characters for individuals, like we're doing a mobile game right now for Kill Shakespeare, they're using the original character designs that Andy had worked on, and he also did six sample pages, which we'll probably release in a future like omnibus edition. It was six pages that would have been in the original comic book, the original issue of the Sea of Troubles, like issue number one that came out in April of 2010. But we decided we need to redo some of those pages, so eventually we will release those six pages.
And so how did he go about designing, say, the individual characters? Did you guys have ideas in your head and present them to him, or was it just like, just draw Hamlet and let's see how it goes? Like,
we played it back and forth. I mean, we gave him some visual references of, actually a lot of it was with actors or actresses, mm-hmm. that we thought kind of captured, the core of these characters. And so Andy, you know, kind of went off that, and then he put in his own touches. Like Romeo was actually an example of an old painting we found online of a crusader, sort of this like tired, worn out crusader, and we liked that idea of this Romeo who'd become this holy warrior and was ultimately going to be questioning his faith in Shakespeare. You know, Lady Macbeth was there's a picture of Angelina Jolie that we found, and we're like, you know, that's kind of the feel we want for Lady Macbeth. You know, smart, beautiful, with, you know, a bit of an edge. And that's kind of how it went back and forth. With the new series, we sort of gave Andy a bit more free rein in terms of we gave him some ideas for what we wanted to do with character design, but, you know, he'd sort of proven himself, and we really let him kind of go on a run himself and sort of make some of the decisions. The Prospero design was a really neat one, and I think people really loved that, because all we sort of told him was we wanted to get away from the Gandalf-style wizard that's so popular, and Andy came up with something that was great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, I mean, he's great. I think, like I said, I can't say enough about him. I think he's fantastic. What made you choose IDW above all the others? Like, what was it about IDW that you really enjoyed? And if you hadn't maybe found a publisher, were you just going to self-publish and just go ahead and do that?
We were impressed with IDW right off the bat. We didn't know anyone there. I found an email address of Chris Ryle, the editor-in-chief at the time and still today. And we were able to talk our way into a 10-minute meeting with him. So we sat down with him and Greg Goldstein, the CEO of the company. We just really liked them off the get-go. I mean, we liked Chris's creative direction for the company. We liked how business, how they really approached the industry from a business perspective, especially Greg. As business students, we could really appreciate that. And then also, at that time, they were probably the most ambitious company digitally. And that was something else that we kind of thought would be very intriguing for Kill Shakespeare. So, yeah, I mean, it was a combination of those factors that kind of made us go with IDW, and I mean, we don't regret the decision at all. If we'd been unable to secure a publishing deal, then yeah, we would have done the self-publishing route. It would have been a lot more difficult to do, but I think we would have been able to pull it off and pull it off with some aplomb.
Sure.
It's funny because Connor and I teach sessions and workshops now at Comic Cons all the time about how to get a publishing deal and how to market your comic and stuff like that. So we've kind of become small pseudo experts on this, and we get asked that question all the time: whether you should go the self-published route or the publisher's route. And for Kill Shakespeare, we definitely feel that going the publisher route was the best fit.
Yeah. Oh wow, that's great. And so, what about some of the? I mean, you guys have gotten almost sort of like universal praise for this book. I mean, it's just, it's getting great reviews and deservedly so. But I know that there have been, I think when we met Anthony at Comic-Con, WonderCon last year, or we had talked a little bit, like what about, say, I guess the Shakespeare, for lack of a better term, fanboys who have been like what are some of the criticisms that you've had to deal with as far as like the book is concerned? Any big ones that stand out? Or
yeah, I mean, I think what we talked about then was something that's still brought up into conversation at Comic-Cons when people see us all the time, just because it was such a huge kind of controversial, I guess you could say, at the beginning, was that there was a Shakespeare scholar in New York named Kimberly Cox, mm-hmm. Who had read the first issue of Kill Shakespeare and absolutely despised it. Mm-hmm. And she posted this long rant about it, against it, I guess, on bleedingcool.com, because Rich Johnson, the chief there, had passed it out to number of Shakespeare scholars. Ben Crystal is another one who we're now friends with, and is a fan of Kill Shakespeare. And two out of those three Shakespeareans, or Bardolaters, I guess you could say, did enjoy the first issue, but Kimberly Cox didn't. She wrote how she wanted to bitch slap us. She mentioned three times over the course of this rant that it made her want to throw up in her mouth. But the only thing she specified that she didn't care for was that, or her only like specific criticism was that we chose not to write in iambic pentameter. Uh-huh. You know, we didn't write it completely in old English, OLDE English.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that would be against the purpose of the project for us. I mean, because as we've talked about, we want to make this as accessible as possible for everyone. And if you write in old English, you're going to alienate a huge potential market right there.
Uh-huh. Wow. And so it was only really one big critic. I mean, right? It wasn't anything like several people on like some Shakespeare board, like, oh, harumph, harumph, or anything like that, right?
No. Yeah, there hasn't been too much of that. I mean, I think like people kind of have this weird sense that Shakespeare scholars are all these kind of old, stuffy. I think it kind of all flows in how we teach Shakespeare in high school, right? Because we teach Shakespeare in high school, you know, like it's this big effing deal and it's going to be really tough and this is going to be like the key to all literature. And I mean, in some ways, yeah, that's true. But it sort of totally skates over the fact that Shakespeare's incredibly dirty, that there's lots of, like, really broad slapstick-like humor. You know, this is, you know, we like to talk about how Shakespeare is really a Spielberg or a James Cameron type who dealt with spectacle and dealt with grand emotion. One of the things he just did better than everybody else is when he got into, like, the nuance of, like, what makes us tick. He showed an uncanny ability to sort of dive into that. But I mean, you know, when you meet Shakespeare scholars, they're all kind of nerdy, geeky, interesting people. They like the fact that they're playing around with Shakespeare. Now, they're not going to agree with everything we do. And in fact, Dr. Toby Malone, that Anthony mentioned earlier, one of his papers on Kill Shakespeare is actually kind of slapping us around for all the errors he sees that we made in the series. But it's still done so in the context of, hey, I think this is a really neat idea, just I'm a Shakespearean scholar, and I can tell you why these guys aren't. You know, so you'll get that kind of tweaking, but you don't really get anybody who comes in and says, oh, well, you've just offended the bard, because Shakespeare, you know, he was a master adapter, or thief, depending on how you want to look at it. And so, you know, there's a time-honored tradition of messing around with Shakespeare's plays, casting, you know, doing plays where, hey, Othello is white and everybody else is black, or, you know, reversing gender and roles and just, you know, timelines, everything. People play with Shakespeare, and I think the Shakespeare scholars get that we're part of a proud tradition of playing with, you know, the context of Shakespeare, but not really changing the heart.
Yeah, yeah, which I totally agree with, and it's funny that you mentioned stuffy, you know, Shakespearean scholars. I mean, my wife is a hardcore Shakespeare head and, you know, knows everything about the plays. I am much lesser educated than she is, but, you know, I showed her the first issue when I got it a long time ago, and she liked it. She was like, oh, this is cool. She's not into comics, but she was like, oh, yeah, no, this is great. This is an interesting, you know, take on it. So you have her approval and my approval, as much as that matters for anything. So you guys are taking this into other media now, right? Like beyond comics, like plays and stuff like that?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No. Our first brand extension, if you want to use the business term, is that we've now formatted it for a live stage show. or live stage reading, as we sometimes call it. It's what it's really cool. What we wanted to do, we were approached by Soul Pepper Theatre back, which is the top one of the top theatre companies in Canada. We were approached by them back in about a year and a half, no, 2 years ago, I'd say. And they had they were fans of the series, and they wanted to sit down with us and see if there was something we could work on together. In the course of that brainstorming meeting, someone came up with the idea of doing it as a live stage reading, or you know, like a live graphic novel, where you project images from the comic and then have the actors read out the dialogue. And that was something we all kind of thought would be amazing. And that's that's what it is. I mean, we're actually we're changing the name right now. We were calling it live stage reading for a while. There's a great theater company in Chicago that's about to do it for 3 weeks next month, actually.
Oh, wow.
And they're calling it a live graphic novel, which is kind of what it is. So what we do is we take the images that Andy has done from the series, we project them up on a screen panel by panel, and then we have actors that read out the dialogue, they create the sound effects live, they do the music live. So it is a comic book or a radio play come to life. And it's really cool. We debuted it here in Toronto in November of 2011. Last fall, it played in 5 different cities, and then this spring, it's going to be in Seattle. It's going to be in Dubai for a week. It's going to be Chicago for 3 weeks, and a couple other theater companies are kind of kicking the tires and seeing if they'd be interested in putting it on. And then in addition to the theater show, we received funding here to put together a prototype for an enhanced graphic novel and a mobile game. So we're working with some really cool developers up here in Canada. And then Connor and I are actually going back to one of the original incarnations of Kill Shakespeare, which is a feature film version. So
yeah,
we're working on the film screenplay right now as we speak.
Oh, wow. That's impressive. Good for you. Are people interested right now, or are you guys just getting the screenplay, you know, set up and polished to be able to present to production companies? Or?
Well, we wrote, we've been lucky, actually. Off of the basis of the comic, we had a bunch of offers from people in Los Angeles and people here in Toronto, you know, kind of inquiring, hey, would you think of this as a TV series? Hey, would you do this as a feature film? You know, maybe a series of feature films. Mm-hmm. And so we went back to our original roots of the screenplay and wrote about 120 odd page draft that got us some really nice feedback and got us into a Sundance lab for sort of transmedia projects. And from there, we got another round of feedback. And so we've been spending the last couple months working with a former Hollywood exec who used to work at New Line back when they were doing Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. And so he kind of brings some of that sensibility that we're looking to kind of put into our world. And so, yeah, we're just now working on a new draft of a screenplay. And ideally, if that comes along as well as it seems like it's coming along, we can take that around and start to show people what this world would look like. And then from there, who knows? Yeah, you know, ideally film, or maybe it goes into TV, or who knows what happens. Yeah. But that project will hopefully, you know, the goal is to prove to people out there that not only have we created this neat world in comic book, but that we can create it in other mediums as well. And so we can still, you know, hopefully shepherd as much of the growth of Kill Shakespeare as possible. Obviously, you know, obviously when you go into a bigger medium, you get the opportunity to work with a lot of other people. And, you know, but we still hope that we can sort of, you know, provide a firm hand on the tiller, as it were, to make sure that Kill Shakespeare doesn't go somewhere, you know, like the UFC of Shakespeare.
Yeah. So what, as far as the comics go, now you've got Kill Shakespeare, The Tide of Blood. That's like 5-issue miniseries, correct?
Yeah, that's
yes,
correct.
Indeed. Yeah.
And then beyond that, are you going to do more Kill Shakespeare comics, or?
We would absolutely love to do that. We've been kicking around some other ideas with respect to new stories that we could tell. I mean, we're blessed in that we have hundreds, if not thousands, of characters and stories in the Shakespeare sandbox that we can kind of tap into at any point. Mm-hmm. And I mean, whenever we go to conventions or just talk to people or get emails from fans, they always ask about other characters that we haven't had a chance to incorporate yet. You know, whether it's King Lear, or, you know, people were asking for Prospero and Caliban, so obviously we have them in The Tide of Blood. So yeah, I mean, we'd love to be able to do that. I mean, The two major series, like the original series and The Tide of Blood, have all been more dramatic and very serious. So we're toying around with doing a 5-issue comedy series or comedy version, like a murder mystery perhaps. So yeah, I mean, we'd love to continue on with that. Nothing's been decided as of yet.
Oh, great. I hope to see more of it, because I really did like the first issue of The Tide of Blood a lot. I loved the first miniseries. And what about beyond Kill Shakespeare? Like, any other comics projects or movie projects or plays or theater? I guess mostly, like, are you, let's just start with comics. Are you going to do anything outside of Kill Shakespeare as far as comic books are concerned?
We've been lucky. We've been asked by a couple of other companies to pitch some ideas to them. So, you know, we can't say anything really about what's going on there, but we've been fortunate enough that we've been, to ask to pitch on some ideas. So we're looking forward to getting to try our hand at some established characters. We've both been working on ideas together, and then, you know, we've been fortunate that this has allowed us to meet so many other great creative people. So we've got other projects that we're developing with other people that we can kind of bounce off each other, which is one of the great things about having a partner like Anthony, you know, is you've always got somebody there whose sensibilities can sort of take me away from my own and vice versa. So yeah, there's a bunch of stuff we'd love to do in comics and really all sorts of different mediums. I mean, we'd both like to be storytellers, for the balance of our lives.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, well, I wish you guys the best of luck, and, you know, thanks for doing this. I really appreciate you guys sitting down and joining me on my podcast. I've been a fan of your guys' work, from the beginning, since I first got that PDF when I was reviewing for Ain't It Cool. So, I just wish you guys the best of luck. And, you know, everyone check out, you know, Kill Shakespeare, The Tide of Blood by IDW. And, are you guys doing any convention appearances that anyone should know about?
Are we?
Are they all in Canada?
Well, all the Canada. Best ones are in Canada.
Oh, jeez.
We'll be all over the place. I'll be in Seattle. Anthony's got, where the heck are you going, Anthony? You've got like a bunch of places that you've got on your list. We split up with so many conventions, we kind of need to split up and cover as much territory as possible.
Uh-huh. Oh, wow. Will you guys be at WonderCon again this year?
I'll be at WonderCon at the end of March. Connor's going to be in Seattle. We're going to do a Toronto Comic Con here in March. We're both attending the Fables Con, which is run by Bill Willingham, the first annual Fables Con Fable Town and beyond, where it's all about literary fiction and that sort of thing in a comics medium, which is fantastic. But it should be a lot of fun. Bill's really trying to put together a fantastic conference that is something unlike you've seen elsewhere. Connor's going to be attending the conference in Orlando for sci-fi fantasy authors. Connor, what's the convention again?
Gosh, it's the International Arts and Fantasy Convention. Yeah, I'm actually really lucky. I'm going to get to fulfill a bit of a dream of mine. I've been put on a panel with Neil Gaiman.
Whoa!
And apparently have found out that they're going to be doing little one-act plays, so I might actually be acting in a play with Neil Gaiman while I'm there. So that's kind of crazy. I'll be in Chicago. Anthony's going to be at WonderCon. We're both going to the Middle Eastern, the second annual Middle Eastern Film and Comic Con in Dubai, where the Kill Shakespeare stage play is going to go on. Yeah, Dubai. We went there last year. It was an amazing experience, and so we've been invited to come back again, which is... It's pretty mind-boggling. Anthony will probably be traveling to, you know, jolly old England to hit up one of London's big Comic Cons, and then later in the year we're going to hit Baltimore and Montreal and the big Fan Expo show in New York. Anthony might hit San Diego as well. So we're going to try to be a bit of everywhere.
Wow, you guys are big shots. What are you doing here with me? That's incredible. That's amazing. Oh, well, great for you guys. That makes me so happy that, you know, you guys started off this comic and everything's going really well for you. That's fantastic. Cool.
To answer the question why we're hanging out with you, we were told you were Canadian.
No, not even close. Sorry. I'm American born and bred. America. Well, which technically you guys are a part of. I mean, USA, I should say. USA! USA! Anyway, I don't want to insult you guys too much, but thanks so much for sitting in with me and doing this. And, you know, hopefully I'll get to hang out with one of you or see you for a little bit at WonderCon. And, you know, I'll be keeping up, you know, on the Kill Shakespeare goings on. So thanks for sitting in on Part Time Fanboy.
Anytime.
Thank you. Yeah, I look forward to hanging out with you at WonderCon.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you.
Part-time fanboy.